Welcome to Museum Theatre Musings, the podcast which assumes that you either know what museum theatre is or you're just very fond of compound words. I am your host, Jo Klein, and I am broadcasting from my very executive museum theatre office that in no way resembles my dining room table. In the last episode of the podcast, we looked at an example of Australian practice through the Come Alive Festival of Museum Theatre. But in this episode, I wanted to emphasise the international collegiality of the museum theatre industry by inviting a very special guest, Douglas Collar, who is joining me through the power of the internet, all the way from North Carolina, United States of America. Douglas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Joe.
Now, the very first line of your biography says that you are the president of IMTAL. Now, the IMTAL is a word that we'll be using quite a bit in relationship to museum theatre. We should probably get in there quite early on and explain this acronym. Could you please tell us what IMTAL is?
Of course. IMTAL is the acronym for the International Museum Theatre Alliance. And we are an organization that, in its simplest terms, the mission, I'll give you the mission statement of IMTAL.
Please do.
The mission of IMTAL is to inspire and support the use of theater and theatrical technique in the to cultivate emotional connections, provoke action, and add public value to the museum experience. As to how that happens, there are a variety of ways, and we'll talk about that.
It has got a bit of a history to it. So IMTAL was actually founded in America in 1990 by Dr. Catherine Hughes. Museum theater obviously predates that, but yes, it was a great thing because it kind of brought all these hickety-pickety people together. So a lot of people doing costumed interpretation, some people doing plays in museums, some people doing radio plays, all sorts of other theatrical things in and around museums. And this kind of gave it this cultural umbrella so that everyone could collate what they did and try and see how they could fit into this idea, which kind of this beautiful, beautiful concept of museum theatre. So obviously you are in charge of IMTAL Americas. So we have three. We have IMTAL Americas, we have IMTAL Europe, and we have IMTAL Asia Pacific. And of course, we will go into all of those things in much more depth. But could you just give us a little bit of a scope on IMTAL Americas? Like, what kind of institutions do IMTAL people work at?
Well, we have a variety of members from all over the States. We have a couple in Canada. We used to have some in South America. I'm not sure we do anymore, any active members. I think people are still, institutions are still involved in some way, but we do.
So that's a call out. So if you're in South America and you like museum theater, please get in touch with IMTAL America because
absolutely,
we want as many people from all the Americas as possible.
So I guess the recognizable large institutions are probably the ones that still maintain a really strong theatrical presence. And that is, first and foremost, I think the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. They have a dedicated department. They have actors on staff. Virtually every area of the museum has some sort of theatrical interpretation. They do it so well. And they do it year round. They are extraordinary in the scope of what they do.
I've actually been to the Children's Museum of Indianapolis and I was absolutely blown away. Museum theatre sort of comes first. It's something that's not an add-on. It's very much part of the museum.
It's first and foremost in what they think about and how to reach their audiences.
Absolutely. And the person in charge of that is Tessa Bridle, who was a founding member of Museum Theatre, I think, in America.
Tessa was part of that for a long time. She was succeeded by Todd Norris, one of our former presidents at IMTAL. And Todd is now away from there and in a different business, but he's still involved with Intel. Aaron Bonds, who is currently serving as the membership coordinator, director for our board of directors, is at Indy, and he does a fantastic job. And I met him at my first Intel conference, actually, at Indianapolis in 2011. He has
We do all like to hang out. Museum theater people do love a conference.
They're great friends.
So internationally, what are some other organizations that people would recognize who are part of museum theater in the Americas?
The Science Museum of Minnesota in St. Paul has a long-standing program. Probably, it might be one of the oldest active known theatrical performance areas in the country. I think they celebrated their 50th year recently. They do some amazing work, and they also, that institution has a strong research branch as well, so they mesh very well with what institutionally the goals are and what they can accomplish theatrically. The Smithsonian Institution, we have...
Yes, I've heard of that. I think most people have heard of the Smithsonian.
The big part. And of course, the Smithsonian is made up of a lot of different separate museums, but the Museum of American History and some of the other organizations as well within the Smithsonian umbrella have been very, very active in what they do. The Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York City, which is it's an aircraft carrier that is a museum that houses military and NASA objects as well. Our current vice president and next president of Intel, Alicia Siegel, is their teaching artist there, and she does extraordinary work. The Denver Art Museum, they have a long-standing program that actually won our Lipsky Playwriting Award several years ago, and they have adapted it and done sequels to it, and it's an amazing program.
That's John Lipsky. He sort of became known as the museum theater writer, I think. Like that was sort of his genre. Yeah. And unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago, but there is an award named for him. And certainly a lot of his scripts have endured and formed a basis of with good practice in museum theater writing in some respects, especially for sort of family audiences in large institutions.
He laid the groundwork for how to approach subjects. And we have seen scripts that have been inspired by Lipsky's work and others that take off on the basics and expand that vision. And it's extraordinary to see. It really is. What other institutions? The Los Angeles County Museum of Science, Natural History, I'm sorry. They are known for their huge dinosaur puppets. They're also part of the La Brea Tar Pits Museum, and they have saber-toothed cat puppets as well, full-body suits. They do amazing work.
Yes, often museum theatre people do get in suits. So it's definitely a subgenre of museum theatre.
We like to dress up.
People in suits. So yes, we do love to dress up. I think it's an undeniable part of museum theatre that if you can find a way to get into a costume, we generally will.
Yeah. And along that line, Colonial Williamsburg as well. They do amazing work. And for a long time, it was viewed as expanded interpretation, and you were sort of expected to stay in character there. And they have progressed since then. They're now doing more scripted programming and really addressing some of today's issues through the lens of the past, and groundbreaking, really wonderful stuff.
Well, it is museum theatre obviously has become such a focus on what stories are being told, how they're being told, and also what forms of interpretation are suitable for which institutions and particularly in particular areas. So that's a whole different episode, I feel.
but
you can just keep digging. Everything you've just mentioned, you can just keep digging on those topics and just come up with a whole new aspect of museum theatre. So we get to the next part of this podcast. So in every episode, my honoured guest will be asked to share their museum theatre origin story.
Oh.
Yeah. So we're going to be pretending that we're part of a Marvel film franchise and we're going to tell our origin stories. But basically, it's how they found out about museum theatre or when they discovered that what they were doing actually had a name and a community and an industry, because a lot of people were like little lone islands doing their thing at their museum. And then they found other people who were doing similar things. And we all collected under this giant umbrella called Museum Theatre. So please, Douglas, share with us your Museum Theatre origin story.
All right. Well, I made my living from a very early age as an actor and director in theater, film, and television, radio, commercial voiceover, things like that. And did that for many, many years in Los Angeles and New York, and also regionally in theater in America. Several years ago, I was living about 12 miles west of New York City in New Jersey. And my wife and I decided that it was time to get out of that heavily taxed area and move south because the thinking was that I was doing a lot of regional theater then. I could still go to New York for auditions and go out and work. So we moved to Charlotte, North Carolina, where then I proceeded to spend the next several months in Boston directing for the Chamber Theater Company, a company that goes out and does theatrical interpretation of American short stories for school kids.
What kind of stories? Like folk stories or?
Things like The Monkey's Paw, The Telltale Heart, The Necklace, classic short stories that are part of the grade 8, 9, 10 curriculum. So they bus in a bunch of schools together to places like the Detroit Opera House, which seats about 5,000 people.
So theater and education is sort of one part of museum theater. So that sounds exactly. Like you're kind of edging into museum and education. Theater and education.
Right. Through that, then I also did a couple of seasons as a guest director at Stonehill College, which is just outside of Boston. And then between shows in Boston, I would go back to Charlotte and my wife and I would say, so what are you going to do for work? And I thought about it. I went back to Boston and did another season of Chamber and then came back and then immediately went to Florida for a couple of shows and performed as an actor. And when I came back, there was a notice in the newspaper that Discovery Place was looking for some staff to man an exhibit about Pompeii. And I had been past Discovery Place, but never been in. It is the local science museum. A lot of people thought of it as a children's museum, but it is really a science museum with a children's aspect to it. And they also have touring exhibits that are sometimes art, sometimes history, and sometimes science. So there's a wide area that they cover. I was hired to be an actor in the Day in Pompeii exhibit. And the character was a gladiator. And I had got to work on a monologue. I got to have some input into the monologue that I worked on. And 12 to 15 times a day, among the body casts of the Pompeii exhibit, I would emerge from the shadows and tell the story of this particular gladiator. And it was an extraordinary thing to see the reaction of people, because this was a human story. And they were there amongst these artifacts. And to have them make that connection between the body in front of them and the human in front of them telling the story of these people was an amazing thing to be part of. And to do that several times a day and have people moved by the story and hear them later talking about it amongst themselves was an experience that I really hadn't had in my life. So that was how I got involved at Discovery Place. Now, part of that was I was hired roughly a month and a half before that exhibit opened. So in addition to learning that monologue and being ready to go into the Pompeii exhibit, I was also trained as a presenter. Discovery Place has an aquarium, they have a rainforest, and they do science shows on the daily as well. So I learned all of the science shows. I learned how to handle iguanas and snakes and spiders and do the aquarium tours. And I learned how to mix chemicals and blow things up and do the science shows as well. So I was doing that on the days when I wasn't in the Pompeii exhibit. And we eventually expanded the Pompeii exhibit to also have a Roman senator walking amongst the people who were lined up to get in and talking about the politics of the era. And then when they got into the exhibit, there was a Roman matron who was teaching rudimentary Latin and working with a drop spindle, teaching people about the drop spindle. And if you played your cards right, she would also translate some of the filthier graffiti on the walls in there. But you had to be very quiet. And then they ended in the body cast. So we had, at any given time, three actors involved in the Pompeii, plus daily science shows, plus aquarium shows, plus animal programs in the rainforest itself. It was, without us labeling it, it was already a very active theatrical presence. And that was due primarily to, and we'll talk about this a little later, to the CEO at the time, who had been with Discovery Place for years and years. And it started as a teen volunteer when it first opened at the Nature Museum, and eventually became CEO. So getting back to me, I worked my way up through the staff at Discovery Place and eventually was put in charge of the floor presentation and got a chance to write and direct more theatrical programming, as well as add more and different programming to the science shows and build programming around the rainforest animals. And it just sort of expanded from there. And we kept doing traveling exhibitions, and it got to a point where we conditioned the exhibit staff to ask us what we needed theatrically. At first they were, you know, it was an afterthought, but eventually by the time I left and by the time we finished, that was one of the first questions that was asked in planning meetings. Doug, what do you need for the theatrical side of it? And that was an amazing thing to be a part of, to have that acknowledgement that this was valued and they wanted to put it in the forefront. But that was how I ended up at Discovery Place, as an actor and then as a manager and still performing.
And you were there for 12 years. So obviously,
13, yeah.
You got to see a lot of different types of performance. I'm just having a little laugh here because one of my early brushes with museum theatre was 2008, 2009, when I worked at the Melbourne Museum as a programs officer. And we had a day in Pompeii. We had the casts as well. So I'm thinking this was about the time of the world tour. Was it about that sort of?
Yes, I think Discovery Place was its first stop in the US, first or second.
And the way we added museum theatre to it was Bernard Callio, who is somebody who, you know, has been a very huge presence in museum theatre in Australia, sort of wrote these pieces where it had a live presenter and several actors on screen, and they were different characters. There was a gladiator, there was a slave girl, and gosh, I'm trying to remember who else there was, maybe a scholar, I think. And their job was, it was, you know, those last couple of hours leading up to the eruption and them basically explaining what they did, what their life was like. And same deal, you would go to the exhibition hall and you'd see the exhibition. So it was that really nice connection between, you know, adding that live element, and it was a very, very positive experience. So it was just so wonderful to be part of that. But it's interesting that, you know, Pompeii is such an international story that museum theatre performers all over the world interpreted it through performance. So it sounds like you sort of worked your way through sort of theatrical aspects, theatre and education before you write an actual museum. And when did you kind of go, oh yes, I'm working in museum theatre?
As part of my duties at Discovery Place, I was involved with NISNET. It was the Nanoscale Informal Science Education Network at the time, and has since become the National Informal Science Education Network. But it was an organization that was dedicated to introducing the concept of nanotechnology to the American public. And there were representatives from all sorts of institutions. And we had a meeting in Wisconsin, and I and my immediate supervisor attended this. And there I met folks from the Science Museum of Minnesota who, you know, like recognizes like, and they said, you're an actor, and have I got something for you? And I was told about IMTALK. As I've said in the past, Stephanie Long, who knows a sucker when she sees one, turned me on to IMTALK. And there happened to be, I think, within a couple of months, there was a mini conference scheduled for Indianapolis. And so I made sure I was able to attend that conference. And it was a day and a half conference. And then there was also offered a 3-day museum, theater and museums workshop with Tessa, where we worked on
Tessa Bridal, who has written about museum theater.
She's got at least three books about the subject out there on the market. An extraordinary woman. She's really lovely to work with. Very determined. She knows exactly what she wants. And she was a joy to work with. And one of the things I got to do at that conference was work with Aaron Bonds, on a program that was giving them some fits that just wasn't playing as well as they wanted to. So we deconstructed the script and rewrote it in a couple of days and tested out a couple of different versions with the audience and found one that worked. And I'm happy to say that script is still being performed there in Indianapolis. So that makes me happy.
That makes me happy too, that if something's been created well, it can have a long lifespan as a interpretive technique. That's wonderful. Now, if this was a paid podcast, we would have just paused for a message from our sponsor.
Right.
So if anyone think of a sponsor who would love to support Museum Theatre, please get in touch. However, we're going to just, it was really just a tea break, but we're going to get on to the really nitty gritty part. So one of the things of this podcast, we are going to be asking everyone to speak about something that they would like other people to know about, and that is a form of expertise they've built up over time. And one of the things that I hope that people listening to this podcast might want to know is how you can get a cultural institution such as a museum, an art gallery, a heritage site, a zoo, or an aquarium to support, value, and implement a museum theatre program. So could you just tell us a little bit, you've spoken already about support from a CEO, but could you tell us a little bit more about this topic?
I will say that when I came to Discovery Place, the theatrical side of things had been fallow for many years. And it was due to a young man who was a manager in the education department who brought it up again and restarted the idea of the program. And took that to the CEO. And as I said, John Mackey is an absolute legend in American museums. And he is, in addition to his many talents as a museum professional, he's also a musician, so he plays guitar. So he was very familiar with the performance aspect of things. And when Discovery Place first opened in the late 70s, the Uptown Museum, it had actually started in the 50s as a nature museum in Charlotte. But they had performers on staff. They hired student actors to be their presenters. So there was always a theatrical aspect of it. And over the years, they built that up. And there was actually a 200-seat theater in the museum dedicated to theatrical performance, where they did most of their programming. And somehow, along the way, as happens with actors, things got confused and the program was erased and never to be spoken of again. Someone had crossed a line somewhere, or something had happened, or someone showed up in the wrong state of mind, or whatever. And so they stopped hiring actors and hired teachers, which was fine. They still did programming, but it wasn't theatrical in nature. So in restarting the theatrical program, John made it clear that he thought that this was a viable thing to do, and it was valuable to the community and valuable as a signature of Discovery. And he was right. One of the things I think is important is if you're in a position of any kind, of whether you're a presenter or a manager, get to know your volunteers. Almost every group of volunteers has at least one person, probably more, who have some sort of theatrical background. They've done school plays, or they're musicians, or they're magicians, or they do other things, they're puppeteers, and they want to perform. And it doesn't have to be a huge thing. You can say, hey, I was talking to our volunteer over in collections, and they had an idea for a puppet show that might work for the kid area. Let's try that out using volunteers, and we'll get some feedback and see what the crowd thinks of it. And that's important. You want to collect feedback. One of the things we didn't do early on at Discovery Place was document the feedback. We started doing it fairly soon after, but for the first year and a half, we really didn't have a lot of audience response recorded. But you want to do that so that you have the ammunition to go to the senior team and say, this is what the audiences are saying. This is what they like. This is what they respond to. And you're going to have the pushback from them saying, well, we don't want to be known as that. We don't want actors. You don't have to have actors, but you want to have people who understand how to present. And these people understand how to present. They know how to touch an audience and make them understand something that they may not have understood with just the basics that are written on the wall or the title cards on the paintings or whatever. That's critically important, that you have people who want to convey that information and want to go in depth. For a long time, we had the tension at Discovery Place of, do we want teachers or do we want actors? And we had a mix of both. I will, spoiler alert, we eventually ended up with separate teams. And by the time I left, we had a team of four part-time interactors who shared duties across shows. And then we had two rotating extras who would step in occasionally, in addition to the 21 general presenters and floor staff that we had. But they all shared duties and they all knew the shows. But the interactors were the only ones who did the scripted shows in the theater and floor character interaction. But actors or teacher? Well, in my estimation, and I'm prejudiced this way because I'm an actor, first and foremost, I think that any actor worth their salt loves research. They love to dig deep into their character and they build a whole life story. Well, I was very fortunate to be able to portray Vincent van Gogh in an exhibit. I had a young lady on staff who wrote a script that was based on Vincent's writings and things from his letters. And it was a wonderful script. It was about 10 minutes long, just long enough for the people entering the exhibit to have an encounter with Vincent and then move on to see the rest of the exhibit.
You actually have some physical similarities. I mean, I know this is a podcast, but I'm just looking at Doug here and I would definitely cast you as Vincent. You've got a little bit.
I'm a bit older than Vincent. Even when I portrayed him, I was older than he lived to be. But I did go to the extreme of actually coloring my hair and my beard at the time. In addition to Vincent, we had his brother Theo. We had his model, Adeline Ravo. And so depending on what time of day you came through the exhibit, you could see any one of these characters and hear more about the story. And they were wonderful scripts, and audiences really responded to it. And as immersive, and that was Grande Exhibits, Van Gogh Alive, which was the first of the major immersive exhibits with the projections on the walls and on the floor and things. And Grande really set the bar very high with that exhibit. And we were fortunate enough that they said, yeah, let's have a theatrical element. Go ahead, do it. Let's see what happens. And the audience feedback was extraordinary. People were in tears at the end of their encounter with Vincent and really took something with them into the exhibit that helped them understand even more of what they were seeing. And in that exhibit, they saw everything that Van Gogh ever painted, ever drew, ever wrote. It was all projected. And you could spend as much time as you wanted in that exhibit. And then loop back and maybe see Adeline Ravo talk about Vincent or see Theo talk about, because we rotated throughout the day. So that was extraordinary. But it was, as an actor, it gave me a chance to really dig into this character. And Vincent was multilingual. He did speak English and French and Dutch. So I worked with tapes, audio tapes, and developed a Dutch accent. And our Theo also had a bit of a Dutch accent. And Adeline had a bit of a French accent. So there was the feel of that as well. And we had costumers, the theatrical costumers, who came in and dressed us and made us look like the era. And it was wonderful. And that was something that we were very proud of doing. We ended up doing historical characters when appropriate. And some museums will shy away from doing known characters like Vincent. They will have a farmer who knew Vincent and they will tell stories. And that's fine too. We just preferred to have Leonardo da Vinci tell his story rather than somebody who knew da Vinci tell his story.
Now, conversations with other museum theatre performers and scriptwriters, there's often a copyright issue in performing a person. You think, well, that person's been dead a long time. Yes, but sometimes production companies have the rights to things,
sure.
or there is a family, like not necessarily Vincent van Gogh, but perhaps someone more recent in history. So were there no issues with you performing?
There were none. None that we encountered, and you have to do your due diligence, of course. You have to, you know, do the research and find out whether this is even possible. But you shoot for the biggest story you can get and then work backward from there. If you're shot down, that's fine. And we were fortunate enough to be able to have Vincent and, as I said, Leonardo da Vinci. And in a Pirates and Shipwreck exhibition, we had Calico Jack Rackham and Anne Bonny. And tremendous stories. The Calico Jack Rackham was actually a very, very dark story. It happened as he was ascending the gallows, and he stopped to address the crowd. And it was a bleak story, but it was well received. And then there were times where we were just wandering the exhibit in character, and that gave people a chance to talk to us up close and personal and get the story or pieces of the script, but not have to sit still or stand still and listen to the whole story. They could get a part. That was fun.
How much work did you do with curators or archivists? I just, when you talk about institutional support, it's not mm-hmm. just management, it's also the other departments. What kind Absolutely. Of relationship did you forge with those departments to create this piece?
We had initially a difficult time getting marketing on board because they had their own plan. And marketing, at least at my institution, was planned out 18 months to two and a half years in advance. So they knew what was coming and they had already plotted out what they were going to do. So to have some wacky actor come to them and say, oh, we're going to do this, and you know, we want you to promote this, they were resistant. So there were times when people didn't know that something was happening until it was sprung on them. And the response was almost universally positive, but it took a while to get marketing on board and realize that we were getting positive feedback and this is something they could work with. And eventually, again, at the end of my tenure, they were writing pieces specifically for the interactive. They would say, can we have your team do this? Can we have your team do this? And that was all the thanks we needed, quite honestly. They would say, we want to do a web series with these people and we want to send them out to this civic event and we want them to do this. And that was everything to us.
I hadn't really thought about the marketing aspect in times of resistance because museum theatre is so marketable. It is so visually arresting. And the contrast between often sort of flatter exhibits and having a live performer in costume standing in front or adjacent to really often is at the forefront of visual merchandising, I suppose, for museums. So but it's interesting, of course, because, you know, they had their departmental plan. It's something to definitely take into consideration. What kind of lead-in time do you need to get everybody on board for a museum theatre piece? Because obviously marketing and promoting an event is so, so important to actually get people to come.
There are, and then as far as writing the material, you know, we all took a stab at it. I wrote the pirate stuff. I wrote a lot of the Da Vinci stuff, not all of it. I worked with my staff member, Hannah, who is a gifted writer and has a really strong voice. And she did the initial research and laid out how she thought the monologue would go. And she wrote several of the drafts and eventually ended up being the main writer for our larger theater shows as well. And then we would also use outside writers. We commissioned a script from one of the Lipsky Award winners. Because Discovery Place was part of a program that received a Tesla coil from an organization that was promoting the use of Tesla coils in the museum. And ours happened to be a music Tesla coil. We had PJ write a script, and he eventually called it Tommy Thunder's Heavy Metal Lightning Show.
Sorry, just to clarify, you said musical Tesla coil.
Musical Tesla coil. So you could program the coil to play rock music. And,
wow, okay.
We had a coil to play Highway to Hell and other things. It was great fun.
Amazing.
And so this script was about a 25-minute script about this guy, Tommy Thunder, who had been a rock star in the 70s and was really his touring plane was struck by lightning at some point, and he encountered a lightning ball, and his life was changed, and he was all about weather and weather patterns and the behavior of lightning and his manager's goal to get him back on track. But all he wanted to do was sing about lightning and sing. So it was a musical show, but it also had a lot to do with Tesla's development of his alternating current and his quarrel with the DC power. And of course, we ended up with AC/DC. And so we played AC/DC to it out. And you know, the audience walked out to a musical Tesla coil playing Thunderstruck, which was so much fun. But
that was my question. Was it performed inside the exhibition space or in a theater space?
It was performed in the theater space. We didn't have a space. It was actually a portable Tesla coil, so we could roll it on and off the stage, so we could use the stage for other shows, which we had in repertory. But there was no place in the museum that was safe enough aside from the theater. So we would block off the first two rows of the theater just to be sure that no one would be zapped along the way. And the interactors were trained on how to operate this, and we rehearsed very carefully and followed all the safety procedures. But it ended up there were two people in exhibits, and the interactors and me were the only people in the building who knew how to operate this Tesla coil.
That's so interesting. You don't really think about museum theater being an industry where you might get electrocuted by a Tesla coil. It's not something that's really up there with one of your major concerns.
Or stabbed by a gladiator or a pirate. One of the things that we were aware of, and I think anybody who's worked in the museums, and everybody has a different way of referring to this, Discovery Place, we refer to them as speedsters, strollers, and scholars. People who come to a museum and the speedsters just barrel through the exhibit. They don't read any of the title cards. They don't engage with the exhibits. They just are there to walk through and say they did it. The strollers are the ones who come in and they will read the title cards. They'll read what this exhibit is about. Maybe they'll see a show at the stage and watch us blow up something or freeze something or lay on the bed of nails and have an experience. And they're there for a longer amount of time. And their kids get a little bit more of the experience. And then there are the scholars who want to be immersed. And they will spend several hours going through every, and in a science museum, that can be quite a lot. And particularly at some place like Discovery Place, which is multidisciplinary. So you have an aquarium, you have a rainforest, you have animals to interact with, you have science shows where people are making weird smells and blowing things up and freezing balloons. And then you have these stage shows as well. Plus you might see a 3D movie or you might see an IMAX film in addition. And also get hands-on with stuff in the labs. So there's plenty of things for the scholars to do. And those are the people who you really target. You target the strollers as well, but the scholars are the ones you want because they spend the most time with. And they're the ones who are most deeply affected by what you're doing because they will take the time to see the show. They will take the time to fill out the survey. And they will take the time to give you the feedback, the valuable feedback that senior team and marketing wants. And your team wants as well. Because you want to adjust your programming to suit the needs of the visitor, but you also want to have your own voice heard. So there's a happy medium.
And that sounds like the absolute perfect place to wrap up. So what I'm hearing, sort of my takeaway message is, it's important to have a champion who will say, museum theatre is not just great, it's also valuable to our cultural institution. The other thing that you mentioned, which was really fantastic, was the importance of pilot programs. So before you go ahead and maybe hire actors and, you know, create a large scale production, you could start off doing a pilot with volunteers or similar and see how it goes.
You can also engage for very low cost and sometimes on a volunteer basis as well, a local theater company or a local school, college, technical school. And generally, they're more than happy to have people come in and do something. And that's where we got most of our wardrobe. We hired people from the local colleges, from the theater department, to build our wardrobe for us, as historically accurate as we could make it. Nice. So you always have an avenue. There's no excuse not to at least try to do something. And there's no exhibit that can't at least be, I won't say improved, but enhanced by a theatrical engagement along with it. It may not seem like it at first. You have to dig deep sometimes. But you sit back and you say, this is a really wonderful exhibit about Van Gogh. This is a wonderful exhibit about Da Vinci's machines. What can we do to bring a theatrical element to this? What can we do? We had an exhibit about Genghis Khan. And while we didn't have any Mongolians on staff, there is a local Mongolian community in Charlotte. In fact, one of the leading Mongolian poets in the US lives two blocks away from me here in my home. And she was thrilled to be able to ask, to be asked to be a participant in this. And she put us in contact with a Mongolian dance troupe. And we worked out so that every fourth day we had special exhibitions of Mongolian dance throughout the time of this exhibit. And again, that gave marketing something to promote. It added an aspect to this exhibit that you wouldn't, that didn't come with it. It was just an add-on experience.
Important community engagement.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's interesting what you've just said, that you can enhance an exhibition that's already good. But a few other people have discussed the fact that sometimes you can improve an exhibition that isn't that good. So if something's mm-hmm. not engaging people, how can you add a theatrical layer to it to make it something which resonates more with the public? The last thing you've mentioned, which I think is really important for all of us, is evaluations. So finding out what people think about your performances. Is it helping them connect effectively with the museum? Is it hitting the right target audience in terms of age? And is it resulting in more engaged visitations? So it's really great to hear what the museum visitor is thinking.
I have a tip for that. I'm just going to throw this in. In our 200-seat theater at Discovery Place, very often we would have the surveys ready to go, but people didn't want to hang around and fill them out. So we put an incentive on it, and we worked this out ahead of time. If they filled out their survey and they took it and turned it in at the gift shop that day, they could get a 10% discount.
So Douglas, as we get to the end of this podcast, do you have any final words for people who are interested in pursuing museum theatre, maybe based on your own experiences?
I had known when I started as an actor that museum theatre existed. I would have spent all of that time that I worked as a temp in offices or worked in a blood warehouse or worked as a security guard or whatever. I would have been in a museum trying to do theater and engaging audiences and working on my people skill. So if you're a performer listening to this, seek out a museum to volunteer and maybe end up on staff and maybe build a program like we're talking about.
Douglas, thank you so much for imbuing us with your knowledge and your insight.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jen.
The theme music for this episode is the title song from These Curious Things, a piece of museum theatre written by Michael Mills of Heaps Good Productions in Adelaide, Australia, and performed by Gemma Dandy and Michael Mills.